Hey, Undisclosed listeners, we hope that you are as excited about this special episode featuring an update on Adnan's hearing as we are. And this special episode was brought to you by our great sponsor, Thumbtack. Listen, Thumbtack stepped up for us to help us make this episode, so please support Thumbtack because Thumbtack supports us. Enjoy the program.
On Thursday, June 8th, the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland held oral arguments in Adnan's case. The purpose of those arguments was to review Judge Welch's order granting Adnan a new trial. The state, of course, is claiming that Judge Welch incorrectly found that Christina Gutierrez was ineffective in failing to cross-examine the state's cell tower expert with the AT&T disclaimer that said incoming calls are unreliable for determining location status. On the other hand, the defense is claiming that Judge Welch should have found not only that Gutierrez was deficient in failing to contact prospective alibi witness Asia McLean, but also that deficiency was prejudicial or undermines the confidence in the jury's verdict. The oral arguments were held at the Court of Special Appeals in the state capitol in Annapolis.
So the morning of the hearing, which actually the hearing took place at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, Adnan's mom, Auntie Shamim, as I call her, arrived to my home. I live in Bowie, which is about 20 minutes from the Capitol. And we headed over together. We got there about a couple hours early to make sure that we could get seats, although they did have reserved family seating. But I'm not exactly family. And then my husband was there, my daughter, brother, and you never know who's going to get in or not. But it just so happened on the way there, Adnan gave us a phone call. We didn't talk much about what was going to happen. He was just kind of making general chit-chat, keeping the mood light. And we got there, and as we pulled in the parking lot, a bunch of other folks we know who've been following the case, some people who do some research for us, pulled in. Chris Flora, Adnan's former attorney, got there. Justin showed up, and then lo and behold, I saw Thiru Vignaraja pull in as well, and we kind of all cautiously avoided each other and walked into the courtroom. There was a big line already, luckily, though, and I didn't see Susan. I hadn't seen her yet, but I was with, like I said, the family members. They ushered us in first. Now, it's important for people to know, because I've been asked the question numerous times, you know, what about Adnan? Adnan is not there. In these proceedings, the defendant, he's not there. And I've been in this courtroom before, well, not this exact room, but I've been at this court with Auntie Shamim before when his first appeal got to this level and it was argued at COSA. And it was just me and her. And again, defendant didn't show up because these are strictly legal arguments. There's no testimony. There's no evidence offered. Anyhow, we got in, small courtroom, and I spent the whole time looking at the door waiting for when Susan Simpson would walk through and get a seat in the courtroom, which didn't happen.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had other stuff to do that day, so I knew there was a chance I might be too late, but I was hopeful. And I got there, I think, like 1:20, and already the line was pretty long. And I don't even remember how many got in or how big the room was, but I did not make the cutoff. Someone tried to shuffle me ahead in line to get me in, and I was... next up, they're like, oh, we'll have five more in. Nope, zip. So I did not make it in the courtroom.
It was, it was only 67 people in the courtroom. And the interesting thing is when the whole room got full and I didn't see you, there were two seats and they were all numbered. Everybody got a number. There were two seats that were empty. And so I talked to one of the folks working there. I said, hey, you know, one of the attorneys working on the case is stuck outside, you. And then I was trying to get Methel in. I said, can they take those two seats, you know? And it turned out those seats were reserved for Thiru's mother and sister, who actually I don't think showed up. I think the seats remained empty.
So I was actually outside of the courthouse for the hearing. And then afterwards, I got to hear from everyone who was there. And it sounds like, well, Methel, actually, she went in to try and, you know, finagle way in. And she could see.
And Methel, by the way, is our executive producer, for those of you who don't know. And she showed up wearing a free Adnan t-shirt, which they forced her to turn inside out, which I thought was really weird because it's a court of law. And hello, First Amendment. What happened?
But anyway. Yeah. Well, she was trying to, you know, make something work out. And she came back and she's like, no, it didn't work. But I could see like the screen on the security guards thing. And I could see Thiru making a lot of arm movements.
Was there a lot of media outside during the thing?
There was a lot of media out there. But luckily, Methel managed to get a copy of the CD of the audio. So we had that basically immediately after the hearing.
Yeah. So while Susan didn't get in and I wasn't up in Maryland, we did get to hear the full oral arguments before recording this episode. And here's the way it worked. It was a 3-judge panel that heard the case. And that's just luck of the draw as to what judges you get. But from what I can tell from the oral argument recording, it was pretty clear that all three judges were extremely qualified. They were well-versed in the subject matter, and they were prepared with questions that revealed a really solid understanding of the key issues on appeal. So the three judges who heard the case were first Chief Justice Patrick Woodward. He worked for several years in private practice and actually served as 7 years as a circuit court judge, a trial court judge, before joining the Court of Special Appeals back in 2005. The second judge was Catherine Grafe, and she was in the Criminal Appeals Division of the State Attorney General's Office for 18 years before she joined the Court of Special Appeals in 2008. And the third judge was Alexander Wright Jr. He was on both sides of the bar in practice. He was an assistant public defender and also an assistant attorney general before becoming first a circuit court judge, again, a trial court judge, and then later a court of special appeals judge in 2008.
So the state went first. They presented first. They had 15 minutes. And Thiru Vignaraja, as I mentioned before, he represented the state just like he did in the PCR proceedings last year, even though he no longer works for the attorney general's office. Both sides had 30 minutes, and Thiru decided to take 15 minutes to begin his opening arguments and reserve the remaining 15 for rebuttal after Justin presented his case. After Thiru briefly laid out the broad strokes of the state's case, Judge Grafe immediately jumped in with a question that is at the heart of the alibi issue.
Have you found any cases that have found that it was a reasonable trial strategy not to investigate an alibi witness?
The first thing I would say, Your Honor, is that we don't have cases that say there's no obligation to fail to investigate. But, of course, Ms. Gutierrez did investigate. Mr. Gutierrez's defense team did investigate an alibi defense quite extensively.
Well, Judge Grafe, however, redirected Thiru back to the central question.
Have you found any cases that say it's not ineffective assistance of counsel to fail to interview and pursue an alibi witness presented by the defendant?
We are unaware of any cases that identify a particular theory with respect to that, but the state respectfully submits that the principles of Strickland in itself make it clear that that kind of obligation would be far higher than what is expected by the Supreme Court and the Constitution.
Yeah, and this really is the heart of the matter for the alibi issue. Strickland is the Supreme Court case that sets forth the test for ineffective assistance of counsel. And while the state in this case would like the court to believe that it can justify a decision not to contact a particular alibi witness, it hasn't throughout the course of pleadings and now oral arguments been able to find even a single case supporting this proposition in the face of hundreds of cases reaching the opposite conclusion. And so possibly acknowledging this problem, Thiru tried to pivot to a claim that there was conflicting information about when Adnan received Age's letters and showed them to Gutierrez. But Judge Grafe wondered whether this mattered.
Does it matter if it's clear from the file that she had information that Asia McLean was a potential alibi witness?
I think it is important, Your Honor, because the rule of contemporaneous assessment requires us to judge the decision-making of the attorney at the time of the decision.
Right, but she had that information prior to trial, correct?
She did, but there are two different stages in which I think defense counsel has theorized that information was given.
At that point, Thiru was trying to go back to his PCR argument and to claim that essentially Asia's letters were a lie, or at least could have been construed that way by Gutierrez. And while he was doing this, Judge Wright jumped in to clarify when Judge Welch actually reached his conclusion.
Was that a finding of the circuit court that interpretation was it offered to lie?
In its original ruling, that precisely what the circuit court said.
But in terms of what's up before us now?
In the second decision, Your Honor, the circuit court did not re-engage that particular question. But the state respectfully submits that if a circuit court...
But if the circuit court didn't re-engage it, but the circuit court, and by implication, indicated that because it went to the prejudice prong, that it must have accepted that it was not an offer to lie.
Your Honor, I think that there's two answers to that. One is that there is no basis to think that the
And Thiru said that there's no need for Judge Welch to re-engage with this question because there was no new information on the issue at the reopened proceedings. Judge Wright did not seem entirely sold on this.
If it was only relevant to prejudice, why was so many questions that went to whether or not it was an offer to lie? In the post-conviction hearing.
Your Honor,
is that true?
That is true. And
Theroux's response was that this issue was indeed covered and that some of the testimony raised questions about the information that Asia had included. And Judge Graff's response was that was to ask why it wouldn't make sense for someone on the defense team just to call Asia if they had questions about what she was talking about or about her credibility on the letters alone, which I'd like to point out is the only reasonable course of action in order to come up with the crazy convoluted theory that Theroux has here that would take probably a solid week's worth of effort to piece together all these like bits and claims. So rather than spending like 40 hours trying to parse together a teenager's letter, the reasonable course of action would be to pick up the phone and call.
To call Asia. For Gutierrez to have called Asia, yeah.
All of Theroux's arguments assume that Gutierrez actually had enough knowledge of the case to even recognize the things he claims to be discrepancies, which she did not. But then Theroux launched into a response that when I heard it, it shocked me because this case has been going on for years now and Theroux has been involved for years now. And at this point, everyone should be familiar with the basic facts. So I didn't and I still don't understand how he could have said this.
And at that stage, once you've received preliminary discovery and you've asked your client what their account is and they don't mention it in July, when Mr. Syed's testimony was that it had fortified his memory as soon as he got the letters, even after that, if you look at the memoranda in the defense file where Mr. Syed is talking to his attorneys, Mr. Syed, in August 25th, provides a detailed recitation of what he had done that day during the school day. And there's a memorandum that encapsulates that so that even in August, he did not mention the Woodlawn Public Library or Asia McLean.
Did he mention the library at all? A library?
He did not. He did not. And so when you have an advanced stage of the proceedings in July and August, and Ms. Gutierrez now has a lot of information, and your client is not telling you that that's where you were, other witnesses are not suggesting that that's where you were, to suggest that that's a rabbit hole worth going down, I think is beyond what Strickland requires.
That's just not true, though. Adnan told his attorneys about Asia in the library at least two separate times, and one of them we know for certain was in July, July 13th. An associate attorney who worked with Gutierrez and a law clerk visited him that day, and they took notes and they dated them, which show that, yes, on July 13th, 1999, Adnan told his attorneys, quote, Asia McLean saw him in the library at 3, Asia boyfriend saw him 2, library may have cameras, and there's also his email, syedadnan@hotmail.com, and his password. Which to me indicates that maybe he's like, hey, check my email and see if you can find like emails that support this. Although back in those days, they didn't save your sent messages, so that wouldn't do much good. And then again, below that, it says track started at 3:30. So they're talking about a schedule and his timeline after school that day. And he has Asia front and center as part of this. And there's also a undated set of notes written by Gutierrez that say something similar. They say Asia and boyfriend saw him in the library. Went to library often, 2:15 to 3:15, 3:30 practice started. And that page is not dated, and there's a few dates it could have been written on, but in Gutierrez's files, it follows notes taken on July 10th, which is a day Gutierrez did visit Adnan in the jail, so it may have been taken then. But regardless, we know for certain, in July, this is what Adnan was saying. So when Theroux tells the court he did not, referring to whether Adnan ever mentioned the library or mentioned Asia specifically, in July or August, that's just wrong.
You know, so when I was sitting there and I heard this, I was sitting behind Justin and his team from Hogan Lovell. You know, they're the firm that are working on the case pro bono as well. And I was just like staring hard in the back of his head, thinking, okay, Justin, I know you're gonna like address this when you get up. He didn't, but here's the thing. Like, so I had a long conversation with Adnan about what happened at the hearing earlier this morning. And I explained a couple of the, I would say, misrepresentations that were made by the state, this being really the big glaring one. And we were talking about, you know, what are the possible courses of action when the state does this? And this happened at the PCR hearing. It happened at trial. And, you know, he said, you know, one of the frustrations for people who are defendants who are incarcerated, it's like, what do you do in this situation? Especially at a COSA hearing where defendant's not there, he can't nudge his lawyer and say, hey, I want you to respond to this. And we were discussing the possibility, apparently somebody he knew who's incarcerated with him was concerned about some of the proceedings when he read the transcript that had happened in his COSA, but he wasn't there. So he actually wrote directly. He wrote directly to the Court of Appeal, and they actually wrote back. They wrote him back. And so I guess that's one way to do it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to advise that. But so here's the good news. What Theroux said was starkly wrong. And although if true, it'd be, you know, a significant fact for the state's case. Like, hey, he never even told her about Asia or the library. But luckily, it's Judge Welch's findings that control here. And unless the Court of Special Appeals finds clear error in those facts, Judge Welch's facts won't be reversed, which means what he wrote is reality. And here's what Judge Welch found. The notes found in trial counsel's file further indicate the petitioner informed trial counsel that McLean was a potential alibi witness. According to notes dated July 13, 1999, petitioner informed trial counsel's law clerk that McLean saw petitioner at the Woodlawn Public Library around 3 on January 13, 1999. Trial counsel also noted that McLean and her boyfriend saw petitioner in library from around 2:15 to 2:45. So, again, that's like a well-supported factual finding. Court of Special Appeals is not going to accept whatever nonsense Sarah was saying up there. But still, to me, it was very... That's such a huge part of the case, misrepresented from the start. I was surprised.
But, you know, it was interesting to me because they seemed to know the facts of the case very well. So when they asked Thiru about this specifically and kind of repeated it, and he said, no, no, he did not. He never mentioned it. I was thinking, are they buying this? Are they testing Thiru? Or are they like, what's happening here? Like, I was surprised to hear that exchange.
The judge was clearly surprised, too. But then again, like, they're judges. They have a million cases they're working on. They know the facts really well, but they don't know them like the attorney should. So when Thiru's up there insisting this is a fact, the judge is naturally going to be like, oh, I must have mixed that up in my mind. But again, they'll go back to the record and they'll see what really happened.
You need to hire someone. A plumber, a DJ, anyone. Thumbtack finds them, for free. Thumbtack.com matches you with the right local professionals for any project. Just tell them what you need and when, and they'll have up to 5 estimates tomorrow. There's no more sifting through 75 million search results. No more asking neighbors if they know someone. Thumbtack finds exactly who you're looking for. They'll ask a few questions about your project, then use that information to find pros that best fit the job. They're available when you need them, within your budget, reviewed and verified. Thumbtack does all the legwork, and you can pick your favorite. Within 24 hours of submitting a project, you'll have up to 5 estimates from local pros that match your criteria. Check out their prices and reviews, chat with them directly if you need more information. Pretty much anyone you need to hire is on Thumbtack. Carpet cleaners, personal trainers, photographers, even piano teachers. They'll help you find pros in over 1,000 categories in all 50 states. I looked into thumbtack.com because my house is over 100 years old, I'm not very handy, and I'm one of those people who will spend hours researching things. Thumbtack.com made life so much easier. I just plugged in my information, and 24 hours later, I had a great list of handy men and handy women in the area. And now you can do the same. Thumbtack makes it easy to find pros for pretty much anything you need done. Download the app or try it now at thumbtack.com. Yeah, so after this discussion of when Adnan had told Gutierrez about Asia and the library, Thiru next turned to Adnan's testimony that Gutierrez talked to him at some point after he had given her Asia's letter and told him that she looked into the alibi and that nothing came of it. Now, it seemed to me from listening to the arguments that Thiru was trying to use this as evidence that Gutierrez did look into Asia, but before Thiru could finish his thought, Judge Graith jumped in.
Ms. Gutierrez had actually come to him and said, we looked into it and nothing came of it. We think that...
Looked into what?
Looked into the alibi of Asia McLean, and nothing came of it.
But didn't talk to her.
We're not sure, Your Honor, that there's no question, there's no record evidence that she talked to Ms. McLean. I want to be very clear about that.
But there's extensive record of speaking to other witnesses, and so the extent that this is not there sort of undercuts the fact that she actually spoke to him.
That's right, Your Honor. I don't think that the state is submitting that there was some preliminary conversation. What we are submitting is that an alibi is not just a witness. It's a witness at a particular time and a particular place.
Now, at this point, Thiru tried to move the discussion to the definition of an alibi witness, and that led Chief Judge Woodward to enter into the oral argument with a bang.
But that's the problem, counsel. The problem is that trial counsel, defense counsel, never talked to Ms. McLean. Nobody from her office talked to, to Ms. McClain. According to the testimony of Mr. Syed, he told his attorney to talk to her. How can you have any kind of an evaluation of an alibi witness based on some very general letters that talk about time frame of 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. and not talk to the person to see whether there's any information? That is reasonable under the state's view?
Theo responded to this by saying it would be unfair to place a categorical obligation on defense counsel to interview any prospective alibi witness, no matter how dubious or inconsistent their story is, which prompted another forceful response by Chief Judge Woodward.
Strickland itself.
But how do you know if it's inconsistent if you don't talk to the person? You had her first letter span this wide range of time. It also may have had things about helping him, but that letter also had things that if I can help you, if you're innocent. She was, caveating that. I'm not going to help you if you're guilty. So how can you possibly evaluate an alibi witness if you don't even talk to them?
Theo's response to that was that Gutierrez's predecessors, the attorneys who had the case before she entered the scene, did investigate the library alibi by talking to security guard Steve at the library. But Judge Wright noted that this investigation wasn't fruitful.
Even if it is the case that it would have been appropriate to do a preliminary call, there is evidence that Ms. Gutierrez did several things resembling that. Number one, her predecessors went to the Woodlawn Public Library and spoke to someone, the security officer, who might have been able to account whether or not that was a plausible leg of the alibi. That was part of an original alibi investigation that involved talking to six different individuals at Mr. Syed's suggestion, given that Mr. Syed had spoken with the defense attorney and the private investigator.
But that security guard wasn't helpful or not helpful, was he? I mean, he didn't say that, no, this didn't happen, or the library was closed that day, or anything of that sort.
Your Honor, we do have a challenge here in the record insofar as the security officer doesn't recall what he would have said or whether he even had a conversation. We are having to refer to the cold record from the defense file. Ms. Gutierrez is not able to testify. She's deceased, of course. The private investigator is as well. And so the presumption of reasonable conduct is particularly important to fill that deficit. The sides have traded competing theories as to what happened, and in fact, the judge at the lower court said that these are equally plausible theories. And when the state respectfully submits their theories in equipoise, the presumption of reasonableness allows the tie to go to the state.
To me, it was heartening to hear that the panel was well-versed enough in this case to know that in the PCR hearing, security guard Steve's testimony was a flop, factually, and they weren't interested in hearing about it. But the state's argument here seems disingenuous. On the one hand, Theroux argues to the court that Anand never mentioned the word library to his attorneys, so why would Gutierrez possibly believe it when it finally does come up? But on the other, he's saying that, yeah, the PI went at, quote, Anand's suggestion to speak to alibi witnesses, and that included the security guard at the library. So he wants it both ways, that the library was checked out at Anand's suggestion in, like, March, and also that Anand never mentioned the library even in August.
But, you know, he does this on a number of different issues, and is this kind of alternative arguing the same facts? Like, for example, when it comes to Asia, he argues that either she's offering to lie or that Gutierrez believed her but thought it would, like, mess up her client's case. Like, can you do that in this? Like, can you offer, like, two different competing arguments that completely kind of cancel each other out?
You can do that. It just also undercuts your own point, which is that if there's a lot of ambiguity here, the answer is to figure out what's going on, not to throw up your hands and say, it's probably bogus, so let's not find out that this witness is actually amazing, as she was. And on security guard Steve, perhaps more frustrating to me was the misquote of the trial court's decision. You heard Theroux say there how the presumption of reasonable conduct is particularly important here to fill in the deficit left by the fact that Gutierrez can't testify. And he said, quote, the sides have traded competing theories. And in fact, the judge at lower court said that these are equally plausible theories. And when the state submits, there are theories in equipoise, the presumption of reasonableness allows the tie to go to the state. But that's not what the court wrote. What Judge Welch found to be in equipoise was Theroux's random speculations about how Asia found out the address to write to Anand at, as compared against the court's own random speculations about how Asia found the address. Judge Welch wrote, The state argues that it is highly questionable that a 17-year-old high school student could have obtained petitioner's booking number just 2 days after his arrest, suggesting that petitioner or his agent provided McClain with the booking number and other information found in the March 2nd, 1999 letter. While the state's speculation is plausible, the state is essentially asking the court to favor one conjecture and ignore other equally plausible speculations. Perhaps out of a desire to write petitioner, McClain asked her friends and teachers about how she could contact petitioner while he was incarcerated. Another possibility is that McClain could have asked petitioner's family about how she could write to petitioner when she visited his house on the night of March 1st, 1999. So what Welch was saying is that what Theroux wants the court to do is say Gutierrez could have made up an explanation that made McClain not a good witness and therefore didn't contact her. And what Welch is saying is, like, you can make up a million reasons to explain these facts, but you can't just, like, make up a million reasons, find the worst one, decide that's the truth, and roll with it. When there's ambiguity, you have to find out what the actual reality is. Whereas Theroux wants the court to conclude, if there's ambiguity, you can assume the worst and never check it out.
Yeah, and that's the Griffin case from the Fourth Circuit basically says that exactly. Right. To say that this is speculation, the point of the court is to say, well, no, we shouldn't speculate. We have a plain record. It seems clear what happened, and we can't come up with these explanations for, well, maybe the attorney was thinking this. No, that's not what's done. And that's exactly what Susan is pointing out, that Theroux's interpretation of Judge Welch's writing doesn't match up with the case law.
Yeah. And even worse, he's saying, Theroux was arguing that Judge Welch found factually that, you know, Theroux's Ocean 11 style conspiracy theory for Asia is, quote, equally plausible compared to the factual evidence that Anand put forward in the form of Asia's testimony. Not the case. That's not what happened. The judge was comparing random speculation, not the defense's case versus the state's case.
It's hard for me to believe that he doesn't know that. I feel like he probably knows the record pretty well to know that what he's saying to the Court of Special Appeals is not accurate.
Well, this isn't the record. It's possible he just misread it. I mean, it's the court's opinion, so he should know it well. But
or misunderstood it.
It's possible. You can misread stuff like that. But at the same point, I hope the court is able to read what the words actually say, which they will be able to.
So Theroux then turned to the argument that he made at the reopened PCR hearing, which when he brought this up, it was hard for me not to roll my eyes. And the only reason I didn't was because Justin had told us beforehand not to make any faces during the arguments. And that was this, that the alibi that Gutierrez was developing for Adnan was school, track, mosque, his routine, school, track, mosque. And so any attempt to use an alibi like Asia that deviated from that routine could have been damaging to the defense. So let's take a listen.
Here, Ms. Gutierrez's defense was not that he left the school and went to the public library, but that he stayed at the school.
Does it matter that the public library was very close and on the same grounds? Is that relevant?
It's the kind of thing that the defense attorney would have to make a judgment about. The suggestion that she was unaware of the distinction between the Woodlawn Public Library and the school is belied by at least several facts. Number one, the private investigator actually went out to the Woodlawn Public Library and visited there. They knew physically where it looked at. Number two, in that same memorandum that says making determination about alibi urgent, if you flip a few pages later, there's actually a list of maps where they've asked for maps to be part of the to-do list. There are maps for the school, there's maps for the track field, and there are separate maps for the Woodlawn Public Library listed. So the suggestion that the defense team didn't appreciate the difference, I think, is belied by the record.
So, you know, every time Theroux makes this argument, I can't help but think how he personally has to know how stupid of an argument, and it's completely disingenuous argument this is, because he was a Woodlawn student, too. A few years before Adnan, and like all other Woodlawn students, he knew what a meaningless claim this was, because the map argument is just a waste of breath. I mean, this claim wasn't part of Judge Welch's factual findings. So essentially, Theroux was asking the court to reverse the trial court's factual finding on this point, replace it with his own factual finding that because Gutierrez asked for a map of the Woodlawn School, the Woodlawn track field, and the Woodlawn Library, she acted reasonably in instantly concluding that Asia's letters were not credible. And the court just isn't going to do that. But beyond that, you know, one thing I don't understand is he keeps trying to make this argument that Gutierrez was strategically developing this defense in which his routine was going to be his alibi, is the fact that she actually never raised this as a defense. In trial, she did not raise this as a defense. So, you know, there is no routine alibi defense prepared. There was no defense prepared at all for the time frame in which Hay was killed. Gutierrez did talk to people who she thought might have seen Adnan in the evening, but she had absolutely nothing prepared for like during the time, you know, that Hay disappeared and in the daytime. So he keeps making this argument, but the truth is, wouldn't she have to actually have tried to use this as an alibi during the trial for him to say that it's even plausible that this was her strategy?
Or like talk to the track teammate who Jay says saw him pick up Adnan. That would have been a good place to start.
Right. She didn't. She simply did not try to craft a defense, a routine alibi defense, or any kind of alibi defense for that period of time. Simple as that.
Yeah, so after Thera made this routine alibi argument, Chief Judge Woodward jumped back in to ask how Gutierrez could have made this determination about preferring one supposed alibi over another without speaking to Asia herself. And this prompted Thera to raise one of the hypotheticals he posed to the defense expert at the reopened PCR proceeding.
It raises a real concern.
Let me answer by giving an extreme hypothetical. If my alibi for my client is that he was in California at the time of the murder, and somebody sends me a letter that says, I actually could account for his time in Maryland between 2:15 and 8 o'clock, we immediately know that you don't need to call that person.
Now, in response to this hypothetical, Judge Grafe wondered out loud whether the facts in this case were meaningly different from the facts in that hypothetical.
Stayed at the school.
Does it matter that the public library was very close and on the same grounds? Is that relevant?
It's the kind of thing that the defense attorney would have to make a judgment about. The suggestion that she was unaware of the distinction between the Woodlawn Public Library and the school is belied by at least several facts.
So at this point, and following back up on Rabia's point from before, Thera tried to explain to the judges why Gutierrez knew the difference between the school library and the Woodlawn Public Library, but then Judge Wright jumped back in and noted that Asia herself had testified at that reopened PCR that students frequently referred to the Woodlawn Public Library as the school library.
But would the investigation, if they talked to Asia McClain, as she indicated in her testimony before Judge Walsh below in this appeal, that when people speak about the library, they speak about the Woodlawn Public Library as the library in conjunction with the school.
And then finally, Thera closed with an argument he made in his last brief. And as we noted in our episode previewing the oral arguments, this was a risky move. According to Thera, contacting Asia
and actually creates risks because that might actually iron out a wrinkle that Ms. Gutierrez herself perceived, which is, where did Adnan get into Hay's car? I don't think there's any obligation under Strickland pick up the phone and call and see how strong that problem could be.
Yeah, normally, I mean, Thera was a strong writer, usually pretty, like, well-crafted arguments, even if I don't agree with them factually. But damn, I want to scream every time he uses this iron out a wrinkle analogy, because he uses it constantly, and it doesn't get better the more he uses it. I mean, like, first of all, again, like what Robbie is saying, it's a total factual inconsistency in his arguments. Like, on one hand, Asia's lying, it's all false, it's all a conspiracy. On the other hand, if it's true, it's damaging and helps the state anyway. So, okay, fine, you want to have both ways. That might undercut your own credibility in your arguments. But also, you have to have an explanation for this. She can't just keep saying it irons out a wrinkle and hope it'd be true. Because Thera has no evidence to support this claim as often as he makes it.
So then it was time for Justin to get his 30 minutes of argument, and he began it by focusing on the deficiency issue with regard to Asia. In other words, was Christina Gutierrez deficient in her duty for not calling her? And almost immediately, Judge Grafe interjected and asked him whether it was his position that under no circumstance is it not reasonable for an attorney to not contact a witness. In other words, was Justin telling the court that no matter what the circumstance, an attorney must investigate any potential alibi witness? And Justin responded in the affirmative. Absolutely. An attorney must contact and investigate every such witness. And the court began pressing him. What if an alibi is totally inconsistent with an attorney's defense strategy? Remember, as we just talked about it, Thera was arguing that Gutierrez was going to use Adnan's routine as his alibi. The judge then began proposing a series of hypotheticals, which were a little bit reminiscent of Thera's cross-examination of David Irwin during the PCR hearing, when he kept asking him, hey, in this hypothetical, does a lawyer have a duty to contact that witness? And finally, after lots of hypotheticals being exasperated, David Irwin responded with a retort if I was told my client was on a space station, something, so, like, he got really exasperated with the hypotheticals.
Oh, yeah. He just, like, it doesn't matter. You have to call.
Well, now, in this case, Justin couldn't respond with exasperation, obviously. He has to be very deferential. But even when the judge asked, well, what if you have conflicting accounts of where your client was at the time of the crime? So let's listen to this exchange.
Did you find any case that says that no matter what, you have a duty to investigate alibi? So even if, again, it's... You say you're in Maryland, they say you're in California. There's a duty to investigate, even if it clearly doesn't help. There's no discretion at all on defense counsel. Is that the test you would like us to say?
Your Honor, again, we're talking about picking up the phone and making a phone call. The testimony of the seasoned defense expert, Dave Irwin, is that you continue your investigation, you leave your options open, you try to learn as much as you can about the facts of the case. This is an alibi witness who's providing their phone number and their willingness to testify. And the reason that this is so important is that there's no more powerful defense than an alibi. And not only does it show that someone is not guilty, but it has the opportunity to show that they're innocent.
So here's a thought I have about this, and that's this. You know, the judge is saying basically that, you know, what happens if you have somebody saying that, you know, I was with your client or I saw your client, some kind of alibi witness, and that conflicts with what your client has told you as an attorney, or your client doesn't know, like your client has no story for where they were. And, you know, we've heard this before with other stories about wrongful convictions, because they often happen because the defendant can't account for the time. If they could account for the time, they could prove it, they probably wouldn't be convicted. So when the defense is not positive exactly where they were at any given time, other than like generally recalling their movements, it seems like if an alibi witness pops up, that witness is kind of even more important to fill in the gaps. And we've already talked about this, but, you know, Adnan did repeatedly say he was at school until after track practice, and then he spent time checking emails at the library, and we have the notes that Susan showed to show that.
Yeah, I'll add here that there actually is a case specifically on point, and I hope the Court of Special Appeals finds it. I blogged about it on May 18th, 2015. It's the Towns case, a federal circuit court case out of the Sixth Circuit. It was a murder case. The attorney was actually deceased, and the defendant initially told the police, I have a routine, and I probably would have been at an arcade at the time of the murder. And then later, there was an alibi witness who defense counsel did not contact, who said, well, actually, on that day, the defendant was helping me move. And the Sixth Circuit in that case found that was ineffective assistance, even though the alibi conflicted with the defendant's routine, what he thought he was doing that day. Absolutely, per se, that attorney had an obligation to contact that prospective alibi witness.
And the judge tried other ways to attest or dissuade Justin from insisting that Christina Gutierrez had a duty to contact Asia. She said that Gutierrez had a list of 80 other alibi witnesses, she had limited resources, that maybe she recognized Asia's letter didn't give a specific time frame. And when Justin pointed out that Adnan seeing Asia in the library after school directly contradict the state timeline, the panel pushed back, taking issue with a section from Judge Welch's opinion.
Even at that point, Christina Gutierrez was on notice that this alibi witness covered the precise time.
Well, let's get to that, though, because in the circuit court's ruling at Appendix 172, the circuit court said, prior to trial, petitioner gave trial counsel two letters from Ms. McLean. The letters indicated that she saw petitioner at a different location during the 2:35 p.m. to 2:40 window. Now, I didn't see that in the letters. I saw the letters as my reading said, as Chief Judge Woodward said, I can help you account for some of your unaccountable lost time, 2:15 to 8 o'clock. And I didn't see that in these letters it was specifically narrowed down.
The judge was on the ball here, and that she was correct. The letters from Asia do not specify a 2:35 to 2:40 p.m. time frame. But I read Judge Welch's opinion entirely different from how the panel did. It seems pretty clear to me that his reference, Judge Welch's reference to 2:35 to 2:40, is about the state's case, not about Asia. In footnote 9, Judge Welch wrote, the state contended during closing arguments that the victim was dead 20 to 25 minutes from when she left school at 2:15 p.m., which would be 2:35 to 2:40 p.m., which seems to me very clear that's where Judge Welch got these numbers from. So what Judge Welch was saying was that Asia's letters describe seeing Anand in the library after school, which is a time that would conflict with the precise and narrow period of time that the state itself argued at the trial. Unfortunately, this confusion comes up again a bit later in arguments in a discussion of Gutierrez's notes.
And then on APX 17, when that, I think, is a little bit confusing. It's not clear whether Asia and boyfriend saw him in library, went to library often 2:15 to 3:15. So it's not clear that this is saying she saw him there, but that suggests that she says she went to the library often between 2:15 to 3:15. So I'm not sure that that really supports the court's finding that she could place him in the library. The court on Appendix 175 says that here, counsel was informed that she could place him in the library from 2:15 to 2:45. And I'm not sure where in the notes that is supported.
Well, I would say that is even all the more reason to pick up the phone and call her. We do know, and I think the court would agree, that it certainly was in the ballpark. We know that school ended at 2:15. So, yes, to some extent, there might be some minor discrepancies about precisely when, but that's the nature of human memory. And that's all the more reason. All she's got to do is pick up the phone and make a very simple phone call.
Justin's save here was exactly what you want to do in oral arguments. Because, well, first, based on the judge's questions here, and without having the documents right in front of you, like you wouldn't if you're giving the argument, it's hard to follow along about what's being referenced and what exactly the judge is asking. And if you do have the documents, like if you're listening later, then it becomes apparent that the judge's question was a bit misphrased. The notes that are being referenced here are the same ones we talked about earlier that Gutierrez wrote down while speaking with Anand. And they say Asia and boyfriend saw him in the library, went to the library often, 2:15 to 3:15, 3:30 p.m., practice started. So that's stuff Anand is saying, Gutierrez is writing down, and it's hard to imagine that Asia and boyfriend saw him in the library could be referring to anything else. The judge seems to think it might be about Asia, but she didn't talk to Asia, which is the whole point. And again, since track practice is mentioned, and since Asia didn't do track, we can be sure this isn't Asia's schedule the notes are discussing. But again, rather than try and dissect all that in the fly, the better option is to do what Justin did. Redirect the discussion back to the heart of the matter, to what's really before the judges that day, which is that all of this could have been simply resolved by a phone call to Asia herself, which Gutierrez didn't do.
Another issue that was brought up actually by Theroux that goes to also this the same thing is that he was making the argument that Christina Gutierrez had enough information at that time that if she about like the theory of the state's case and what actually happened in this crime, that if she thought Asia was going to be like either salient to it or is going to be harmful to her client, that like, she consciously avoided calling her. But here's the thing, this all happened in late spring, early summer of 1999. And at that time, as far as I know, Christina Gutierrez had no idea what the state's theory of the crime was. And I know, you know, Susan, you've written extensively and researched, like, you know, the whole, the timeline of the discovery in this case. And at that time frame, the state had given Gutierrez nothing about what their theory of the crime was, about when Hay had disappeared. I think all that Gutierrez knew was from a very general sense that she disappeared after school.
Shortly after school. That's all I said. And that they'd give more information later, which they did not. But the whole argument, I mean, it seems, even just the way it's being discussed here, this whole issue for the court seems premised on an assumption of guilt. Because it's like the court saying, if this other alibi witness is giving a different story, well, you know, they're telling the truth and condemning your client. Well, no, if your client's innocent, then you've got some crazy liar out there making up stories, which happens. And you want to know what's going on out there. The idea that this could only hurt the case because it's the truth seems to be sort of the assumption underlying it all. And again, if you have a client says, I was here, you got witnesses saying they were there, and you suddenly hear this other person says, oh, no, I was at Six Flags with them. That's something, even aside from the alibi issue, you want to clear up for your client. And if the state might be able to find someone who's going to make up a story or just be wrong, you want to know about that. So there's no explanation and every reason to go ahead and contact someone, even if they do contradict your case.
And this is somebody who is offering to talk to the defense. They gave their phone number. It's not like this is a witness who's avoiding talking, right? But yeah, definitely. I mean, if somebody's going to hurt your client's case, I would think that an attorney would want to talk to that person.
And the other, so one of the things that they keep circling back to is like, well, you know, public defenders do have a lot on their plate. And is it, do we really want to have a blanket rule? It says they are obligated every single time there's an alibi witness that comes up to contact them. Is that fair? Is it reasonable to have this kind of insane, like, ironclad rule? And yes, it is, because think about, like, this situation only comes up when the alibi witness was a strong piece of evidence for your case. It only comes up when the attorney was wrong in the first place. These aren't cases like, oh, the witness was obviously totally wrong and insane and said that the defendant was in California when it was in Maryland. This only comes before the court if it turns out that witness was right. Actually, they did have some information that was helpful to the case and you didn't reach out to them. So it's not about forcing attorneys to contact every single witness on earth. It's saying if there's an alibi and you don't check it out and it actually turned out to be good, then that conviction is reversed.
Right, so next, moving on from the deficiency issue, Justin turns to the issue of prejudice. In other words, did Gutierrez's failure to contact Asia actually prejudice the outcome of the trial? In other words, would it have made a difference in the verdict of the jury? And on this front, Justin came out strong, stating there isn't a single case out there they've been able to find that's been published across the country in which the court found, even though there was a deficiency in failing to contact the alibi witness, there was no prejudice. In other words, when there's a failure to contact, always, every single case the defense has found, the court always finds there's prejudice to the defendant. Now, at this point, Justin went on to make a pretty important argument, which is that Judge Welch based his finding of no prejudice on the belief that the jury was persuaded by Jay Wild's testimony in the cell phone records that Adnan and he were together during the night. But Justin argued the crux of a murder case isn't the burial or anything after the actual crime, it's the actual murder. And the actual murder in this case took place sometime shortly after school. And so on that front, of course, according to the defense, Asia's testimony could have changed the outcome of the trial.
I would like to point out, though, that Weary versus Kane, the Supreme Court case, shows us that it's not about proving that he was an accessory after the fact. The crux of this murder case is the murder. And when you have alibi testimony that puts him in a different place at precisely the time of the murder, that is enough to establish prejudice, and all the cases are consistent with that.
And then right after that, Judge Grafe asked a question that kind of settled badly with me, so let's hear this part of the exchange.
What about all the other evidence against him, though? And the state's argument is that there was so much overwhelming evidence of his guilt that her testimony would not have made a difference.
Well, when you look at both the cell tower issue and the alibi issue, and you take a step back and look at them holistically, that eliminates the sort of pillars of the state's case. And they're left with one shaky witness who told probably...
Now, it settles badly with me because, you know, as listeners of Undisclosed know, we've been successful in discrediting much of this so-called evidence in the past couple of years. But here's the thing. The court cannot evaluate the weight of Asia's testimony against what we know now. It has to evaluate it against what the jurors knew, what was presented to them as evidence, and what Thiru now packages as overwhelming evidence in his briefs. And another thing, again, like I brought up before, when it comes to wrongful convictions, you know, what you have is the tension between enough evidence that led to a conviction versus actual innocence. So Judge Woodward's question about how to evaluate a situation in which you have both a witness or evidence that can exculpate your client and enough evidence that could lead to a conviction doesn't seem to me to be exactly a new situation, because it's what happens in every wrongful conviction where people are finally able to find the smoking gun that exonerates them.
Yeah, in response to this, Justin noted that the standard to assess prejudice for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim under the Strickland case is lower than the standard at either a criminal trial or a civil trial. Question being, is there a reasonable probability of a different outcome had this alibi witness testified? And while reasonable probability might make that seem higher, the preponderance of the evidence standard at a civil case is more likely than not. And so reasonable probability is actually lower than preponderance. So it's below 50%. And that's Justin's point to say, listen, as long as we have some doubt, as long as we believe this alibi witness might have moved the needle, that's good enough. And in response to that, Chief Judge Woodward asked Justin, if it would have been a reasonable probability of a different outcome, what exactly does that mean? What's the different outcome? And so let's listen to the audio of what the chief judge was talking about.
Is the outcome of the proceedings a hung jury?
No, it's not. And you know,
is it not guilty?
Most of the arguments at the oral argument were about Asia and the failure to call an alibi witness. But finally, over 40 minutes into the arguments, Justin tried valiantly to turn the judges to the cell phone issue.
And let me address deficiency of the cell tower evidence here. And we've used some different terminology to describe...
Before you do that, how is it that claim not waived?
That claim could not have been raised until, number one, the cell tower issue came into the case.
Wasn't it there from the day they got the facts? It wasn't anything new. It was there in the file the whole time, right?
Well, no, it wasn't. And this is one of those factual mismatches that often show up in appellate proceedings, because it is a different situation that we have in the trial court. COSA is bound by the record below, and like all appellate courts, they're often dealing with a stilted version of the factual record. And listeners undisclosed will know, this issue here has always been kind of an either-or question from the defense side. The cell phone issue was either a Strickland violation and that Gutierrez was deficient for not bringing it up, or Brady and that the state never produces information to the defense like they should have. And it's a messy factual situation, but the factual issue lost in the judge's question is that the AT&T instruction sheet that's at the heart of this matter, the one that was submitted with the non-cell records, was never actually produced, never in the file, until it was obtained a few years ago from a public information request to the BPD. But again, on appeal, we're dealing with a certain factual record, which is Judge Welch's findings. And his decision was based on the fact that this record would have changed it. Gutierrez should have brought it up. And if she had, Oronowitz, the state's cell phone expert, would not have testified the way he did.
But the court didn't get into all of these actual merits of the cell tower argument. Instead, Judge Grave quickly turns to the issue of waiver, specifically whether or not had waived the cell records fax cover issue because he had failed to previously raise it. Now, in response to this, Justin made three arguments. First, he noted Curtis versus State, that Court of Appeals of Maryland case, which Judge Welch had used to find that the right to the effective assistance of counsel is fundamental, that as such, it requires knowing and intelligent waiver, and that it not, in this case, had not knowingly and intelligently waived the cell tower claim. In response, Chief Judge Woodward groused that this would mean that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel can never be waived.
Don't you have a problem? And I'll give you a hypothetical if, and again, hypothetically only, that if this court should deny all post-conviction relief, and several years from now, somebody looks at the record again and discovers another ground of ineffective assistance of counsel that had not been raised in this proceeding, and a motion to reopen is made based upon ineffective assistance of counsel on the new ground, is that new ground not waived? And if it's not waived, how could ineffective assistance of counsel ever be waived?
Well, let me be clear about what the law in this state is. If you look at the Flansburg case and the Stovall case, such a claim could be raised. It would just have to be framed as ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel.
Okay, that's not my question. My question is, if you raise another ineffective assistance of trial counsel in another motion to reopen down the road after this case has been finalized, is not that issue of ineffective assistance of counsel on the new ground waived?
And again, with all due respect, Your Honor, that's precisely the factual pattern of Flansburg. It would just have to be framed in the sense that the post-conviction
So within this clip, you see Justin's second argument and Chief Judge Woodward's skepticism. In essence, Justin is saying constructively a claim of ineffective assistance is never dead, while the chief judge is saying it's an apples and oranges situation where ineffective assistance of trial counsel is fundamentally different from ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. That then takes us into Justin's third argument, which is that the court in this case doesn't even need to reach the issue of waiver.
Well, wasn't there a final judgment after the first post-conviction hearing? That's the only reason we got it, because there was a final judgment that Judge Welch had entered at the time, and that's the only reason you got up to us. We remanded for the purpose of you reopening, and you filed a motion to reopen. So isn't that similar to what happened in Arrington?
Well, no, because under the Uniform Post-Conviction Act, the order does not become final until either the Court of Special Appeals reverses or if they deny the application for leave to appeal. So, and that, Your Honors, is a way to, if this court is so inclined, completely avoid the waiver issue.
Now, this is a bit complicated, but it comes down to this. Justin's theory is that an issue in a PCR petition can't be waived until there's an order on that petition that becomes finalized. And according to Justin, the order in this case wasn't finalized because the Court of Special Appeals remanded the case back to Judge Welch without ever reaching the merits. Now, if the court accepts this theory, then waiver isn't even an issue. But as you could hear, the chief judge in this case definitely has doubts about this argument.
And it makes sense as to what the court was looking at, because Judge Welch's factual findings here were pretty strong. I mean, he has a very detailed opinion laying out what he saw in the proceeding and what his conclusions were. And factually, unless it's clearly erroneous, this court is bound by that. They can't disagree with what Judge Welch found factually, which makes this issue a foregone conclusion if it's heard by the court. So the real question before them, before this panel, is whether or not they can hear it at all.
So can I ask you both a question? I am actually surprised that, you know, this question, whether or not there's a final order or not, has not been previously litigated. I don't understand this, because I would just assume that this is something that's been before the court over and over again. I mean, it's the Court of Special Appeals. They handle ineffective assistance of counsel appeals. You know, they remand things. I mean, how is this not settled law that when something becomes a final order or not?
Yeah, I would say this goes back to Justin's point, which is I think it hasn't become an issue because you have now the claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. And then usually that's how this happens. The only wrinkle in this case is we had the remand. In the usual case, it would simply be we have the PCR court rules. We have Court of Special Appeals either denies leave to appeal or finds against the defendant. And now later the defendant's trying to raise a new claim and there's no question. It's a final order. This case is unique, and that's the point that Justin was making in the sense that there wasn't a final order. So yeah, 99% of cases, this factual pattern is not going to arise. And in fact, I'm not even aware of any Maryland case before this one where you had a remand before the Court of Special Appeals reached the merits. So that's what's unique about this case.
Oh, I see.
And it's important to remember, though, that the reason this all happened is because Theroux, in his arguments, tried to bring in new factual claims about cell phone evidence. So part of it is that allowing the state to make new sort of factual claims while precluding defense from doing the same. Yeah. But for the most part, the arguments that touched on the cell phone issue were focused on procedural issues, mainly waiver. And at one point, though, Judge Wright questioned Justin about whether Gutierrez could have had a reasonable trial strategy of ignoring the cover sheet. And that's really the only substantive discussion of the cell phone records that the court got into.
But if trial counsel focused in on that, isn't she also saying they are reliable for outgoing calls? And if that's the case, doesn't that sort of undermine what her trial strategy, which was early on in this type of analysis, but which could have been effective?
Well, you know, we're not disputing whether they were reliable or not for outgoing calls, but we know.
But if she focuses in on that, isn't she implicitly accepting it as reliable on outgoing calls?
Well, if she focused in on that,
that is how we're second guessing that perhaps she saw it and said, "Well, I can't use that because it's contrary to the way I'm going to go," which was, as I indicated early on in the attack on cell phones records, which I understand that she did a pretty good job of what she had.
The point of this is that the state itself is saying that that's their best evidence, the proof of these incoming phone calls. You've got this document that says those incoming phone calls are not reliable.
But weren't there other calls that were outgoing that also sort of collaborated the testimony of Mr. Wiles?
There were some that offered some corroboration. Fewer than the state has indicated. There were some, and there, you know, we can't take issue with the accuracy of using those outgoing phone calls. But it's the incoming phone calls that Judge Welch made a finding of fact that was the crux of the state's case. And we know precisely what the state's expert witness, Abraham Wierwanowicz, would have done had he been cross-examined with these instructions and with this explicit warning. He said he would not have testified how he did, and he would not have testified as to the reliability of those incoming phone calls. And that would have been a game changer in this case.
But to me, the court's question here is conflating two different issues, admissibility and weight, because the significance of the instruction sheet isn't as evidence against the weight of the incoming calls only. More importantly is that with the instruction sheet, there's no basis for admitting the incoming calls in the first place. Gutierrez, if she used it, would have had a strong basis for excluding the incoming calls entirely. Doing so wouldn't have weakened her challenges to the weight of the outgoing calls in any way. They're not mutually exclusive. She could have made the same arguments that she made at trial about the outgoing calls that were left in the record. And besides, the outgoing calls were just a blip in the state's case. Jay's story is so wildly inconsistent with respect to those calls that the cell tower information is almost worse for the case there, or at best irrelevant, like, say, the Nisha call. It was outgoing, but Jay says the call was made up in Forest Park, even though the tower listed is Woodlawn and it's on the antenna facing the wrong way. So the idea that the outgoing calls were damaging to the defense's case, or B, couldn't be attacked if the incoming calls were thrown out, doesn't hold up to me. But again, that's all very detailed stuff that's not appropriate for appellate arguments, and that's not the point anymore. The court's general focus here is on what they can look at procedurally, what is within their ability to make, because like I said, substantively, there's not much here to talk about. Judge Welch's order is factually specific, based on credibility determinations and evaluations of the evidence, and I think it's really unlikely that COSA would try and touch that. So there's a broader question that remains instead, one that isn't specific to Don's case at all, and one that impacts the justice system as a whole, which is how long do we want to allow wrongful conviction to matter? At some point, the system says, it doesn't matter if your conviction is constitutionally deficient, and it doesn't matter if you're actually innocent. Your innocence only matters to the extent you can find proof of it within some sort of time frame. So the question for Adnan here is whether or not the way Maryland applies that time frame has already closed for him or not.
That was pretty much the end of Justin's time, and he closed out his arguments, I thought, pretty strongly. So let's hear how he ended his 30 minutes.
We've got to look at these errors in concert, and we've got to look at their prejudicial effect in concert. And when you do that, this is a Sixth Amendment violation. Adnan Syed did not receive effective assistance of counsel. For that reason, he deserves a new trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so after Justin closed, that led to Theroux giving his rebuttal. But before we got into the rebuttal, Chief Judge Woodward asked Theroux to explain why the failure to contact Asia wouldn't be prejudicial, prompting the following exchange.
In argument, the state prosecutor did say in opening and closing that it was likely done, or it was done by 2:36 p.m. That is why...
So why wouldn't her testimony that he was with her and therefore not committing a murder, why would that there not be a reasonable probability that that would change the result of the trial if she testified to that effect?
Because that was a passing reference to the best theory that the state had.
But wasn't that based on a telephone call?
It was based on Jay Wilde's believing at trial that that call was the call where he said it's done. Now, it's important to remember that during the first trial, he had testified that he didn't get there until 3:30.
Now, I have a few observations here. First, as you heard, Theroux ends this clip trying to use what happened at trial one to argue prejudice. And in fact, he did it quite a bit during his rebuttal. And to me, that's an odd choice because that first trial ended in a mistrial. It never reached the jury. And then it was the second trial where the jury had the guilty verdict. And so what was presented at trial one has no bearing whatsoever on the question of how things might have changed at trial two if Asia had testified. And the second part of this is that Theroux acknowledges in this clip that the state's 2:36 timeline was its best theory of the case. And that, to me, makes it really tough to argue that Asia's testimony that she saw Adnan until 2:40 p.m. as anything other than prejudicial. But despite that, Theroux keeps going back to this argument that what the state said about the crime timeline during closing arguments wasn't important, And that prompted some interesting exchanges.
So what the state presented in the second trial was just its interpretation of a particular fact.
Yeah, but isn't the state bound by that? The state goes to the jury, and in the closing argument, the state says, here is the key time, 2:36. The murder had to have happened by that time. It seems when we're assessing prejudice, don't we have to go with what was presented to the jury as the state's theory regarding when the murder occurred? And if the state goes to the jury and says that's the time, or by that time it had to have occurred, then isn't that what we look at rather than, which you may, you're absolutely correct. There's a lot of vagary, and in fact, Judge Welch said that it was kind of a weak theory as to when the murder took place. But once you commit yourself to a certain theory at the time of the murder, don't we analyze the prejudice based upon that theory?
I think I quibble with exactly one part of that, Judge.
Okay.
Which is that the analysis of prejudice is bound by evidence that was presented, not by the state's theory.
Judge Grafe immediately followed up on Theory's point with a pointed question.
Our assessment has to be
Is closing argument part of that analysis?
Closing argument was part of the argument, not the evidence.
So we don't look at closing argument in looking at prejudice?
It's certainly a factor that you can consider. It just doesn't foreclose a jury from saying, I think the attorney is probably a little bit off in that respect. And in fact,
now, it's always tough to get in a judge's head, but I think the Judge Grafe had a particular case in mind. And it's a case we've mentioned before, Ware versus State. That's the case where the Court of Appeals of Maryland said that prejudice, quote, is best understood by taking the word of the prosecutor during closing argument. And Maryland's highest court wasn't just pulling this holding out of a hat. It was citing to the United States Supreme Court's opinion in Collins versus Whitley, which, as we've also noted, was looking at the prejudice based upon the state's failure to disclose that the person implicating the defendant had received a Crime Stoppers tip.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, the next exchange with Theroux suggested that Judge Grafe had another case by this country's highest court in mind.
And I think this is the challenge, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but Christina Gutierrez entering the case was not concerned about the 20 or 30 or 40 minutes right after school. She was worried about the evening. She was worried that the accomplice was going to testify that they spent the evening together, and Misha Khanna and Jennifer Pusateri and Christy Vincent and the cell phone records, putting aside the cell towers for a moment, just the frequency of calls, the duration of the calls, who they called, when they called, was going to corroborate that account. And so taking a scalpel to that timeline and trying to carve out one particular part ultimately doesn't render it prejudice when, in fact, there were scalpels taken to the state's case. There were nits in the state's case that had been created by Ms. Gutierrez's defense strategy, her alibi strategy, her effort to put the father on, say that we were together around the time when he was supposed to be in Lincoln Park. Those are the competing theories and the competing evidence that a jury ultimately has to render.
But the argument here wasn't just that he was an accomplice and he helped Wiles bury the body and get away with the murder. The evidence and argument was that he committed the murder and then with Wilds buried the body. So why isn't, a key component of it was that he committed the murder, and if there's evidence that he was at the library instead of with the victim at the time of the murder, how would that not be prejudicial?
Judge Grafe's comment clearly seems to be a reference to the Supreme Court's recent opinion in Wary v. Kane, which held that evidence undermining the state's theory of the murder itself is enough to prove prejudice, even if the state has strong evidence of the defendant's involvement in post-crime conduct. Of course, even without Wary, it's tough to imagine the judges taking Theroux at his word that Gutierrez wasn't concerned with the 20 to 40 minutes after school when the murder supposedly took place in that time. And finally, it's interesting to once again note Theroux's strategy here. He again acknowledges that Gutierrez scored some body blows to the state's case at trial, but now his point is to say that a jury can still find a defendant guilty despite some weaknesses in the state's case. But it's just as easy to imagine the judges noting all of these pre-existing problems with the state's case and finding that one additional problem, whether it be Asia's testimony or the AT&T disclaimer, would have been the knockout punch. Which takes us to the cell tower records. Simply put, Theroux never got to the merits of the cell tower claim during his oral arguments. Instead, he closed his argument by addressing waiver. And here is the heart of that argument.
What that would mean is that even today, as we sit here, Mr. Syed could file another claim and say, this hasn't been finally litigated yet, and so it's still an open proceeding. That does not seem like consistent with the text of the UPPA, its structure, or its history.
But you agree it's not finally litigated as that term had been understood in other contexts.
I want to just spend a minute because I think this is really important, Your Honor. This case is not finally litigated insofar as if, once it is finally litigated, Mr. Syed could not walk in later and try to advance the same claim that he had before. Final litigation is not a requirement for being barred from bringing in a new claim. That's exactly the argument that was tried in Aaron. They said, no, this is not an even successive petition. This is part of the original reopened proceeding. And the distinction that opposing counsel points to, a great example of this is the case that we cite from Pennsylvania, which has a very, very similar statute called Sepulveda. In that particular case, on a remand, the litigant said, I know this is a new claim, but it's not barred because it's connected to the first one. But the statute that allows liberal amendment of the original petition only applies until the post-conviction court originally rules.
And that's the heart of the dispute over whether waiver is an issue here. When an issue is waived. As noted, Justin has claimed that an issue in a PCR petition can't be waived until that petition is finally litigated, meaning that the Court of Special Appeals has denied leave to appeal or a decision is issued on the merits. And Theo has claimed that an issue is waived when the circuit court issues its decision and that the finally litigated requirement doesn't apply to the waiver. There's no Maryland case directly on point here, and this is, you know, new case for the court in some respects, so it's pretty much up to the discretion of the judges, and it could go either way. That said, a couple points. One is that the order on remand specifically allowed for Judge Welch to look into other matters as he saw fit. That grant of discretion, it could be argued, was itself a grant to do what he did here. It's important to note that this only deals with whether waiver is even an issue here, and that's the only issue that Theo got to on his rebuttal, because if waiver is an issue, Judge Welch might have correctly concluded that Anand didn't waive it under the Curtis standard. But while Theo didn't address the issue, we noted the tough questions to Justin during his arguments about Curtis, which could indicate that the judges here are looking to construe Curtis narrowly, but we'll have to see. What we do know for now is that the state's entire appeal was on the cell tower issue, and yet its oral argument never reached the merits of that issue and only addressed part of the waiver analysis.
I'll tell you how we felt when we left the proceeding. I felt that, you know, the focus of the court was mostly on the Asia issue, which I thought fared well for us. They were pretty tough on Theroux. Justin felt fairly confident at the end of the hearing. What did you guys think after you listened to the oral arguments?
In hindsight, it makes a lot of sense where they focused their attention, because given the appellate, you know, position, they can't revisit the facts about the cell phone evidence. And to the extent that there's prejudice there and it was something that would have made a huge difference in the trial, that's pretty black and white in a lot of ways. So that's not something that this court can touch. They can't touch the waiver issue, so they did touch on that. But the Asia issue, there's a lot more room to play there in terms of the legal questions, because there's not much dispute in the facts. Even Theo was just saying, well, look, you could construe it this way or I could construe it that way. So the question's really basically a simple legal one and not a factual one, which is, was it wrong for Gutierrez not to contact her? And was there prejudice because of it? Which is more factually based. And I think it's interesting that looking at Judge Welch's opinion, he was fairly vague in his factual approach to Asia. There are a lot of facts there. He did go in careful detail through the record. But compare that to what he wrote in the cell phone section, where he meticulously described each exhibit and the cell phone records and how it applied. The way he wrote the Asia section does give more wiggle room for the Court of Appeals. They have more room to interpret the facts to fit whatever legal conclusions they're trying to get to, which I think is exactly why that's where the focus of the arguments were.
Yeah, from my perspective, I would say, first on the cell tower issue, the lack of questions about the actual merits makes me think the state is not going to win in the merits. I don't see any reasonable way that Judge Welch has overruled on that. There was a decent focus on waiver, and I think we noted that in the preview. That is the big question mark. There's not precisely a case in that. So if there's any chance the state wins, it's on waiver, but I don't see them winning on merits. In terms of Asia, I think rock solid in terms of deficient performance. The questions there, Theodore's inability to come up with even one case where this was found to be reasonable performance. I think Judge Welch is not going to overturn on that. In terms of prejudice, I think A, the judges really seem to get Weary versus Kane, which is very helpful to Adnan. I think second, they recognize the importance in Maryland of closing arguments to prejudice in that 215 to 236 timeline. That again helps the defense. About the only thing, and Rabia, this is where you noted a bit of your hesitancy, was they did make the reference to the quote-unquote overwhelming evidence. So if there's any ground to keep Judge Welch's determination on prejudice, it's that. But I think in terms of specificity, this is looking good for the defense to win on the alibi issue. I'm not the first person to say this. Erica Souter, who is a post-conviction attorney in Maryland, said what she took away from the hearing was that quite possibly the Court of Special Appeals might leave Judge Welch's cell tower issue ruling alone, not touch it at all, simply allow it to stand, reverse on the Asia issue, and grant a new trial on those grounds. And that would, of course, streamline their thinking. They wouldn't have to even address the cell tower issue. So I might be on the same page there, that I think the best chance here that we would have of an outcome is no resolution, no change to the ruling on the cell tower issue, and the court granting relief on the Asia claim.
Which would be two grounds of reversing the conviction then, right?
And then also a collateral consequence of that is there's a decent chance under that scenario that the Court of Appeals of Maryland doesn't even allow the state to appeal. It's discretionary. And so, you know, there's always the chance that the court finds the cell tower issue is waived and there's not prejudice on Asia, but there's a pretty plausible scenario out there that this court could rule and that could be the end of the day and the Court of Appeals might not take an appeal here.
Yeah, I think if the if COSA does rule on the waiver issue, I think that makes it not certain, but I think it's close to certain that the Court of Appeals of Maryland, the highest court, will want to hear it because, like Colin said, it's a new issue. There's no decision here on point to, you know, compare against. And novel issues are much more interesting to appellate courts. But if they just sidestep the issue and say, you know what, ruling on Asia, so we don't need to even touch the cell phone stuff. At the end of the day, that's not a new issue. That's pretty black and white and pretty boring, like, IAC law. There's not much in there that's really of interest to the Court of Appeals. It's a high profile case, obviously, but the legal issue itself wouldn't really be red meat for the Supreme Court.
But the Court of Appeals could cert on one issue, not the other, right? They could say, well, we'll hear the cell to the waiver issue. We're not going to hear the Asia, which kind of means at the end of the day, the state is still stuck with. Could it work like that? Or would it just be so it wouldn't matter because he's still getting a new trial?
The Court of Special Appeals grants relief on Asia. The court would have to review that if there's any chance of reversing the order for a new trial. But it could be the case, for instance, right, exactly where if COSA denied relief on both grounds, they could grant appeal on only one of the grounds.
One more question I have, and that's this. We weren't sure what was going to happen with the plea deal issue, which was a issue that COSA reserved before they sent the remand down, and it wasn't touched at all.
Forgotten stepchild of this case.
Yeah. Has it just poof disappeared? I mean, like, isn't that going to be at some point? Doesn't that have to be addressed at some point?
Probably, but no one cares about it anymore.
That's really depressing. But, you know, again, like I said, I spoke to Adnan earlier today, and he said that mentally he believes and he has kind of internalized that the state's going to fight this every step of the way. And so he knows it's going to be a long haul. And so we all have to kind of buckle down for it. All right, guys, thank you so much for helping us get through this oral argument. And great to be back with you, Susan and Colin, again to discuss this case. But we are going to be back sometime this year, all three of us together, on a new wrongful conviction case. So I look forward to that. Just one small note before we wrap up. I want to first thank all of you who have been following Adnan's story and his case for the last few years, and those of you who have reached out to support him in many different ways, whether you've written him a letter or donated to his legal defense fund. But here's the thing. His legal defense goes on. We've raised a couple of $100,000, but we've paid almost the same amount in legal fees, and it looks like the appeal process is going to go on for at least another year or two, and we do need your support. There's two ways we're fundraising. First, you can make a gift, a donation, if you go to launchgood.com/freeAdnan. Again, it's launchgood, L-A-U-N-C-H, G-O-O-D, launchgood.com/freeAdnan. You can contribute whatever amount you're comfortable with. A second way you can help support his legal defense fund is by buying the video of the fundraising gala that we held last year called A Night for Justice. You'll find the video if you go to vimeo.com and search for A Night for Justice. It's only $4.99. For $4.99, you can watch a video of a fantastic program and also help support his legal defense fund. And we also have a link to that video pinned to the top of our Twitter page. If you go to the undisclosed Twitter page, you will find the tweet that links to the video that you can buy for $4.99 right there at the very top. So please do help to continue to support Adnan, because the fight's not over yet.
This special update episode of Undisclosed was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Methil Telhan is our super producer that made sure that we were able to pull it together for you folks. And our great sponsor was Thumbtack. Listen, as an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for a great podcast, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosedpodcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Please, because this was a special update episode on Adnan, feel free to tweet at us using the hashtag FreeAdnan. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you on Monday for the continuation of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, episode 15. Until then.